I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Few people have found the magic formula in publishing twice. Janice Min is one of those people. As the new editor-in-chief of Jan Wenner's Us Weekly in 2003, she put her Columbia Journalism School-trained brain to work on celebrity culture and ended up transforming the culture itself. She satisfied the thirst we never knew we had for Lindsay Lohan, for the real truth about the Real Housewives. She tripled circulation and generated billions in ad revenue. Then she left to transform another magazine, The Hollywood Reporter. It was a drab daily when Min took over in 2010. It sucked up to the studios, and basically nobody read it. Now it breaks news in every issue, a must-read for industry players. So when I was recently in L.A. shooting Will and Grace, I wanted to get Janice Min's take on the business side of TV trends.
All these shows that are rebooting now, like Murphy Brown. I mean, now we'll see the endless ways.
What do you think of that?
I think, like everything in Hollywood, they will exhaust it to the point where everyone rolls their eyes. But then, you know, 10% of them will work out great. And Will and Grace is the prime example of that. It's like they never left and it worked and people are happy with it. If these things are cynically done, thinking the audience still comes, but they don't put in the effort to make it good, then the audience isn't there. And I guess it's as simple as that, right?
Then I watch a lot of other shows, but like Stranger Things and Black Mirror.
Right.
I don't get it. And I wonder if that's what's leading people back to the Will and Grace, which is like, give me a network half hour.
Like, it's familiar, it's comfortable. I think, you know, I mean, there are probably 100 shows I've watched one episode of at this point. I think that's probably incredibly frustrating if you're a show creator because there's no runway for someone to fall in love with episode 3 where things get really good. Mm-hmm. And I remember there was this hilariously sad statistic about how long people listen to a song on like Pandora or Spotify or whatever before they hit fast forward, and it's 3 seconds. Mm. And
it's like swiping right and left on Tinder.
Yes, it's what everyone's fighting against in everything, right? Everything content
related. That's why Katzenberg wants to do 5-minute content for Verizon.
Yes, right?
I want something. While you're online at Starbucks, I got a show for you.
Yes.
It's 5 minutes long.
Right.
And there's a coffee waiting for you at the end of that show.
Correct.
In the arc of your career, the last several years, do you find you have less time to consume any entertainment product?
Oh, my God. I think.
Does Janice Min have like groovy screenings of movies at her house
or
of her celebrity friends or what happens?
No. That is very much not the case. I think there was always this running joke at The Hollywood Reporter that one day someone should do the Janice Min Film Festival showing all these movies that I have never watched while I was editing. I can't sit here and embarrass myself on your show.
A lot of it's gotten by you.
Yes. But some of the greatest movies of our generation have somehow not made them in front of me. So I will often be watching, you know, The Godfather on American Airlines. And, you know,
this looks really good.
Yes,
I hear that's good.
this is one of the things I think is interesting about editing. I'm not adept at that many things, but I think I am adept at this, which is being able to hear what other people are saying about things, to divine from that what the story is without ever actually having to see the movie, see the television show, but sort of understanding the trends or cultural meaning or business story or whatever behind the product.
You became the executive editor of Us Weekly in 2002.
Yes.
I remember when I was making films, mostly in the 90s, the studio, they want a good push and they want a lot of PR. And there's a lot of insistence on you doing a lot of media to sell the movie.
Right.
And you do magazines and you're terrified.
Right.
The writer might get you.
Right.
And they might not get you. And Us was very kind of soft and very people-esque.
It was
very
gooey. The poor man's whatever.
Right.
Yes.
And then when you took over, you kind of juiced it up a bit.
Right.
It became much more tough, if you will.
Right.
What language would you use? When you took over Us, the mission was to do what?
When I started at Us Weekly, I think I was, let's say, 31 years old. And so I was an executive editor to this famous and some would say infamous editor named Bonnie Fuller.
Remember.
So she'd been this figure in publishing in New York in the 90s where she'd gone from Glamour to Cosmo and was always wanted another job and was always, you know, one of these New York Post staples where people were always leaking negative things about her. But she was considered a little bit of a publishing savant. And so she took over at Us Weekly, hired me as her executive editor. And she had a very sort of aggressive story sense about her and believed in this whole crazy thing of like you stay till 4 a.m. and you leave and the sun's coming out and like literally bread trucks were delivering bread at the places on the block. And but she had, she and Jan, you know Jan, does not abide by people with a large sense of ego. And they had these unbelievable clashes. And he grew to really not like her, and she grew to really not like him. And they would have these spectacular fights over stupid things. But
well, for example, what was their editorial debate?
You know, Jan has a ton of celebrity friends, right?
Right. And thought she was mean.
Yes, and thought she was mean.
Right.
And I don't know if I would characterize this as true, but he believed she was jealous of celebrities, you know, wanted to be one of them, and that manifested itself in like a harsher tone than he would have chosen. On top of that, kind of a unwillingness to defer to his wishes. And, you know, if you work for Jan, and I worked for him for 7 years, and it was very peaceful, if you don't listen to Jan, he will let you know he is unhappy with you. And so they would have these things sound so trivial now, but he had wanted some design change on the table of contents, and Bonnie refused to do it. And it's something that, you know, nobody in the world would have ever noticed one way or another. And she refused to do it. And he's screaming at her and in his office. And he has this beautiful wood paneled office with, you know, photos of his family. And shortly thereafter, she was beginning a contract renegotiation with him. This was like 14 months into the job. She had only signed a 1-year deal. And it ends up getting so heated that they have a cooling off period where they don't speak. So I go off on a vacation to Italy. And
you're a genius.
Yes. And then, you know, all of a sudden, like, Bonnie's desperately trying to reach me. And like, she just is one of these people you can't get off the phone. And so I just wasn't responding to her. It was like my first real vacation since I'd worked for her. And then suddenly I find out she just quit. And Jan tracks me down in Italy. And because Jan is Jan, he finds me in this tiny restaurant outside of Florence. And the waiter comes over. He's like, I have a Mr. Winner for you on the phone. And Jan offers me the job. And like, I'm just like a nobody. And it's the whole thing sort of freaked me out. Could I do this? Why would I want to do this? Like, I don't want to be public. I don't want to be criticized. And I saw how mercilessly Bonnie was treated in the press. And I didn't know if I was comfortable with that. And then,
do you think he wanted you? What did he see in you?
Well, a solution, an easy solution right there.
You weren't Bonnie.
I wasn't Bonnie. But also, he and I got along well.
Right. I think he could communicate with
you. Yes. And also, I was the one who kept the place functional amid Bonnie's chaos. And I think you've probably seen this a lot of places where, you know, where there is a very sort of challenging number one, and there was a number two who, you know, a lot of the creative stuff and the ability to actually get people to do things was done through me. And
what were Jan's strengths in your mind?
I really liked Jan. Jan is permanently 18 years old, or maybe even 16. He has so much enthusiasm for everything. And he's like brash and rash and impulsive. And I think for some people that can be very unsettling. But there's sort of probably no better feeling than if you suggest something to Jan. He's like, that's great. And he like bangs a table and he's like, oh my God, that's genius. Let's do it. But then like just as easily, like, you could say, you know, Jan, I had a second thought about that. Maybe we should do that. And he'd be like, okay. And like walk out the door. And like he, you know, I think there's certain things. I think Us Weekly, he realized, wasn't necessarily his wheelhouse. It's not his baby. Like Rolling Stone is his baby that he raised. And Us Weekly was going to be the ATM. It's going to be the cash machine for him. And you know, there was also part of this for Jan where I think he, you know, this is a man who's Rolling Stone defined a generation. And Us Weekly was another generation that he was not as fluent in. And he realized that. But he had these moments of unbelievable inspiration. He became really obsessed with The Bachelor when it came on ABC. And so, you know.
Oh, Jan.
I know. Oh, Jan. And so I never watched one single episode of The Bachelor in my entire life, which is hilarious given how many times it would then appear on the cover of Us Weekly. But Jan had this, there was this one, there's this one bachelor named Andrew Firestone, who was, I think, the second bachelor to come along. And Jan, like, he just this crazy whim. He's like, I believe in it. Let's put him on the cover. And so, you know, I'm like, all right, Jan, you know, it's your magazine. And we put Andrew Firestone on. And he was engaged to the winner. And I can't believe I remember all their names, Jen Scheft. And it became the highest selling issue of Us Weekly in its history time. And so, you know, one of the crazy things was pre-Webmetrics. And, you know, Us Weekly didn't even have a website at this time. And this wasn't even that long ago. It was 13 years ago. You would live and die by these newsstand sales. So you would put an issue out, let's say Thursday night or Friday morning. And so you would get all the scan data. There are these companies that do nothing but scan UPCs. They count the UPCs for you from the biggest retailers. And one of them is Walmart. And, you know, the other one is, you know, some aggregation of maybe like Hudson newsstands and airports. And then you can calculate a sales figure from that.
Mm-hmm.
And Jan, who's like, you know, Jan, who I think would tell you he loves money and, you know, the things that come with money. He was like addicted to it, like the newsstand sales. And because it was a dollar. So every issue you sold over 500,000 copies, which is amazing to think anyone can sell anything, you know, more than 500,000 copies to give a publication. Every issue over that he sold, he made $1.85. And so, you know, after like, let's say after a year of me being there, Us Weekly had gone from losing money every issue where it would sell like around 275,000. And Bonnie got it sometimes touching 500,000, then it started to sell like as much as 1.1 or 1.2 million a week on the newsstand. So you can imagine what that cash looked like.
Real money.
So there's this sort of, but you know, I think probably you and your audience remember this kind of exuberance, I guess an irrational exuberance at the time around celebrity that is gone now. It's gone.
I'm going to write down death of celebrity.
Death of celebrity.
You grew up in Atlanta.
Yes.
Your family moves to Colorado.
Yes.
Your father taught zoology.
Yes.
Your mother's an IRS agent.
Yes.
So you grew up in a pretty heady academic group of people, pretty smart people. You go to Columbia School of Journalism.
Yeah.
So when you're there at this, I'm not going to say, to be kind, Us Magazine, in my mind, when I was doing a lot of magazine covers, was it one of those things on in a pile of other such magazines at the hair salon?
Right.
I mean, it wasn't like a real serious thing. What did you decide
so
you wanted to do?
The first thing is like, I just don't like the mean stuff necessarily. You show sunny wrapping around Us Weekly. So there were things like people smiling. You know, this captured the imagination of young urban women and women who made a lot of money. It was the iPod of publications. It was so cool, and all these other publications followed and couldn't quite be the same. I felt like it could be read on two levels. One, like, you're just a celebrity fan. You actually care about what Jessica Simpson wears. And the other part of it was a tongue-in-cheek look at celebrity. And you could sort of read it as a smart person and be entertained. So taking away the ickiness of being the person who goes to the grocery and buys the Star or Inquirer.
You want to be the thinking man's Star.
No, the cool person's cool, like celebrity publication. And like, so when I worked at People Magazine, I would have never read that. I was, you know, I started there when I was 23, and it was just so middle brow, middle America, you know. It wasn't quite still talking about
it. Wasn't cool.
There was nothing cool about it. It was very like catching up with Lonnie Anderson, you know, and
Lonnie's heartache.
Yes. And, you know, and so there's this whole other generation of celebrity who were coming up through music videos, through reality television. You know, the first year that I started Us Weekly, I think that was the first year American Idol came on air. And so it was this whole explosion of reality TV. So this intimacy that, you know, that's when people started to call celebrities on their first name basis, like Britney, Justin, Jessica, you know, and the whole thing was like some like giant cotton candy machine.
What did you learn at Columbia School of Journalism that you employed when you started working at Us Weekly?
I mean, there
were. Something tells me there's things you learned at Columbia School of Journalism that you employed when you took over Hollywood Reporter.
Sure.
But what about Us Weekly?
Well, at Us Weekly, you know, one of the things was employing journalistic practices on a ridiculous category. So being able to do that kind of celebrity news credibly was I was a big part of Us Weekly reaching.
But did the staff, did you and the editorial staff, did you all sit there and go, oh, God, I can't believe, like, you're writing things about people, and you have a degree of contempt for the people you're writing about?
Think about who were the big Us Weekly figures. Paris Hilton. There was a show on MTV called The Hills, which all young women were obsessed with. Dawson's Creek. Jennifer Lopez. She's, like, the platonic version of an Us Weekly star at that time. She loved it. She read it. She played along with it. She's out there getting photographed, reading Us Weekly.
It was symbiotic.
Totally symbiotic. And that's the thing that was laid bare when you work at a place like Us Weekly, is the sort of push-pull of needing to be in the press and the desire to never be in the press. And Us Weekly was for the people who very much desired to be in the press.
I mean, it's like the bonfire of the vanities, people who really made that deal with the press. They thought to myself, I'm going to just tear off a little piece of me and throw it on this fire and let you consume me.
Yes.
Because it's really good. Because I wouldn't get this attention otherwise.
Yes.
I mean, you certainly aren't going to love me because of my work.
Right. Jan and I would have these funny conversations where he was trying to understand, like, who is an Us Weekly celebrity? And he would say, you know, I just want to see more Danny DeVito and Michael Douglas in Us Weekly because they're his friends.
You have to arm wrestle with him about that?
I mean, like, there were times I'm like, I don't care. So put in, like, well, we'd throw in the occasional picture of Danny DeVito and Rhea Perlman you know, and that makes Jan happy. And
he would
literally come down and be like, I love that photo. I'd say, so do I. And that was it. But it was just a generational shift of how a certain group of women, and Lindsay Lohan is the other prime example, right? Like, who was that, a big fixture of the Us Weekly era?
It's almost forgotten now.
I know.
There was a period when she first started to kind of go off the rails where people were very dismayed. Lindsay was enormously talented.
Hugely.
She did the whole Patty Duke thing and the Parent Trap. I thought she's this young, precocious, very talented girl.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden that just kind of goes away and she becomes this tabloid fodder. Did you see that?
I can't even tell you how strange the Lindsay Lohan stuff is. Like, she directly called people on staff all the time. You know, she, her mother, and, you know, I'm sure some of you remember, the original momager,
Dina.
I guess, Dina, that, you know, would call people on staff. Like Lindsay was, like, she was, among, I'm assuming, other addictions, was completely addicted to the attention, right? And I think if you're a celebrity, and if you're a young celebrity in particular who is raised as a child star, I mean, you know, like, there are a lot of celebrities who are just sort of bottomless pits of narcissism, right? Of need. And also not exercising the best judgment at the time.
When do you realize at Us Weekly that it's time to go?
Yeah. I mean, so it's, you know, there was, I think anyone who does these contract-to-contract jobs at some point, every time you sign one, like, a little part of you dies. You're like, ugh, I'm here for another, you know, 2 years or 3 years, you know, being held hostage and counting down the days and marking X's on a calendar. And so I never really cared about the celebrity subject. I think anyone I worked with at the time would know I didn't care. I didn't care about – I would not personally sit around and talk about Jessica Simpson and Nick Lachey. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of, you know, total grind for 7 years, like a grind where you make a lot of personal sacrifice. Like, twice a week you come home after midnight, and sometimes you come home at 2 a.m. And, like, you always, like, you know, I started that job and we used, you know, Trios, if anyone remembers the Palm Trio, and then it becomes an iPhone by the end. And, like, you are just always working. Like, I don't care how much money I'm going to get paid because I made a lot of money and I don't need to make more. I think to be able to let go of money anxiety at different points in your life is incredibly liberating, right?
That's what they tell me.
Yeah. And so then, you know, I went in. So this was after 2008. There's a terrible financial crisis. Jan, in 2007, you know, something I'm sure he wishes he could take back, where he bought the 50% of Us Weekly that was owned by Disney at the time. He bought it back for $300 million. He gets an offer from Hearst to buy the company for $650, $700 million, and he doesn't take it. And then, you know, boom, 2008. And the whole world falls.
Ad rates go down.
And the multiples at which you could trade a successful publication go nowhere, right? Like, if it was whatever. It's the beginning of the end. And it's like you are in a hole and you can't get out. And so there was that part of it. And I don't know. I just didn't feel like doing it anymore.
You took a year off.
I took a year off.
Be with your family.
Yes. And, like, it was great. And we decided.
How many kids you have?
Now I have three. I had two at the time. Decided that we wanted to move to California, which was, you know, because why not, right? And
you're in New York.
I'm in New York. We lived on Lafayette Street, Lafayette and Prince in Soho in New York. I know.
I love it.
It's the greatest.
Do you miss New York?
I do miss New York. You know.
My wife wants to move here.
Really? Well,
we have three kids.
I mean, to never have to put a mitten or lose a hat. And
you sound like my wife.
Totally.
I'm going to cry.
Yeah. She
can't stand the winter.
Yes. I mean, and
sniffling,
it's
colds.
Yes. And I don't know if you read that.
Indoor play spaces.
Totally.
She's going nuts.
No, we used to do, like,
we're having a fourth child.
Oh, my God.
She's crazy.
I mean, there were times in New York where the weather was so terrible. And we would do things like, should we just go to Target in Jersey City and walk around? I mean, because there's, like, nothing to do.
We're going to go to Kmart on Broadway.
Yes.
Right near
yes.
where you are.
And that's our day, because otherwise I'm going to, like,
we're going to go look at stuff.
Yes, I'm going to go blow my brains out if I sit at home a second longer. So, and, you know, there was, and
like
there were just these days where, like, we had these two young boys at the time where they were just, like, and, you know, the Nintendo DX or whatever, or DS was new at the time, the handheld, and they had, and I'm like, I can't have them play video games all day long, right?
No. And my kids with iPads.
Yes.
You're going to watch an iPad for, it's the electronic leash.
Yes.
Yeah, we give them the iPad for this one so we can bathe the other one.
Totally, right? Yeah. It's just like, sit down and be calm. And
it's
so, like, yes.
Demoralizing modern parenting.
So, you know, New York is a tough place for little kids. It's the best and worst place for little kids. And then, you know, you move out here, and I don't know if, you know, there was a semi-controversial story about that the New York Times wrote about the LA Times and how lame LA is. And, you know, all these people, like Bill Simmons is outraged on Twitter, and people are, you know, think it's like the New York Times, you know, constant theme of LA's a stupid place to live. But, like, it raised some good points that, like, LA's not, you know, as the New York Times argued, not like a real city with a real center. No. Like,
it's the chicest suburb in the world.
Yes.
New York is a mountain range where there's an equivalent height to these mountains of all industries. There's
right.
publishing and banking
yes.
and politics and
yes.
And,
yes.
The, and law enforcement and tech and design. And he said the entertainment has its place among those. I go to parties. I'll never forget, I'm standing in line at Saranac. At the famous mansion at Tanglewood,
yes.
and we're at a fundraiser there for the for Tanglewood, with James Taylor and his wife, and we're there, and some Tweety looking kind of Moynihan-esque guy turns to me. We're in the buffet line. He says, "And what do you do for a living, young man?" I was like 40 at the time. "And what do you do for a living, young man?" He said, and I thought, "I'm in heaven." So
oh
we're gonna
gosh.
Have a real conversation over dinner because you don't know who the fuck I am.
Yes.
And blah blah blah. And in L.A., one mountain dwarfs all the other mountains
completely.
And I find that frustrating.
And I think one of the things that was really interesting to me here was just how deeply intertwined social and business are here, right? Like, so
right.
you don't escape, like, any of the same people, you know, which is why—
We're friends, aren't we?
Yeah.
When you work with them.
Yes. And I think, you know, one of the things I miss about New York, like, you can go— You know, when I was at Michael Wolff's book party 2 weeks ago in New York, waiting for my car to pick me up in the lobby, the doorman and the porter of the building, it was at Michael Wolff's publisher's house, this man named Steven Rubin. The doorman and the porter, like, knew everything about the book, were trashing Trump, were, like, totally, like, you know, knew the day's news, they were totally on it. And, like, that doesn't happen in L.A. typically, right? In New York, you go to Dunkin' Donuts, that person's on it, right?
And, yeah. And in New York, when things are not kosher, they go nuts. And
right.
here people are like, my congressman is who?
Yeah.
My state assemblyman is who?
Totally.
School board politics is all that matters.
Yes.
Where does my kid go to school? That's
yes.
the extent of their government.
Right. I mean, it is so, everything is so hyper-local here. I mean, it's hyper-local.
Hyper-local.
Like in, you know, that, do you know that app next door where you can sort of see what, like you just talk to your neighbors within like a 2-block radius. And that, like, that to me epitomizes LA. And it's like that you don't even need to. Yes, it's kind of a thing out here. And you don't even need to talk to anyone beyond your 2-block radius. And it's
American West.
It is entirely like—
It's the conception of the American West.
Yes.
It's like, what's right in front of me?
Totally.
What do I care about what's going on over there? What
right.
do I care about?
Complete. Like
the manatees.
Free will. And it's like, it's also like NIMBYism.
So you take the year off.
Yeah.
And get reacquainted with your family.
Yeah,
have another baby. Get reacquainted with your husband and have another baby.
Yes.
And when the time's up, you know, you have a copy of the Hollywood Reporter in your hand and going, man, if I could get my hands on this operation, what I would do.
No, no. We originally were going to move to Marin County. Like, my husband and I really loved Marin County. We had bid on a house. And of course, because it's Marin County, we were immediately outbid. And so then right around that time, my favorite, Page Six, had run an item about my apartment being for sale or selling. And so then there was this executive who had been at Condé Nast, who was sort of notorious and legendary, named Richard Beckman. And so Richard Beckman, and he was an ad sales guy, and he had been the publisher of Vogue and Vanity Fair. And so he had connected with this private money outfit called Guggenheim Partners, and they had acquired this group of sort of sad trade titles, and included Billboard, Adweek, and The Hollywood Reporter.
The red and the green, we used to call it.
Oh, how funny. Okay.
When I first came to Hollywood, my friends would say, you got to subscribe to the red and the green.
Oh, that's so funny.
Hollywood Reporter
yeah.
and Variety.
Oh,
we call them the red
yeah.
and the green.
Okay, I'd never heard that.
Right.
That's great. So and so Richard Beckman's desperately trying to reach me after seeing Page Six. This is like a scene out of Working Girl when she finds out something in Page Six, and like chase when Melanie Griffith's character chases it. And it was funny. I have a publicist friend named Allison Broad in New York, and she knows Beckman from being in New York. And she said, I'm sure he wants to talk to you about The Hollywood Reporter. I'm like, The Hollywood Reporter, that is such a piece of crap. Like, I've never even looked at that in my life. And so I go and I meet Beckman at the Bowery Hotel in the restaurant downstairs. And people sometimes jokingly call him like Barnum Bailey and Beckman. Like, the show comes to town and he's British and like wild, you know, gesticulation and enthusiasm. But he had this idea. The investors had put him in charge. They made him the CEO of these titles and said, you know, you can do anything you want, anything. But he said, I want it to be fabulous. It has to be fabulous. And, you know,
promise me fabulous.
Yeah.
I
think he literally may have said, promise me fabulous. And he said, I want it to be glossy. I want it to be like, you know, know, I can't remember what he said. Like, maybe it's like Vanity Fair meets The Economist or and this and that and all his little...
Sex it up for
yes.
me.
And so I, like, trying to sell my husband on L.A. was not having it. So for several months, we talked about this. And then, like, and it was really interesting. Like, to me, I just saw immediately what it should be. He gave me these blank books of paper, this glossy paper, oversized. And I just sat there and I put post-its on every page. I'm like, this is the, like, you'll have this kind of story, this. Okay, like, I got it. That's it. I don't need to think about it anymore. And to me, like, I knew it would succeed, which everybody thinks your thing is going to succeed. But, you know, I had a very good feeling about it. And, you know, we ended up moving to L.A. And it was this we moved here July 10th, 2010. One of the things I know I had to do was hire people with publishing experience from New York, which does not exist in droves in Los Angeles. Mm. And certainly not, you know, not at the time. And hired an art director, creative director, photo director. And
who was your photo director?
This woman, Jennifer Lasky.
Because you really, really did a great job with that.
Yes.
Artwork's
yes.
Amazing.
Jennifer Lasky is a genius. And so this just goes to
you made it into a real magazine as far
yes.
as that goes.
So Jennifer Lasky, and this is how, like, you never know what someone is really capable of. So Jennifer Lasky was this sort of freelance photo editor out of New York, and Us Weekly used to do these really, like, hokey things that, you know, were going to be the last gasp to save publishing called bookazines, where you publish, you create, like, little fan things for $12.95 and you sell them in the grocery. So she was the photo editor of the ones for Twilight. And so she would, like, sit there and look for pictures of Rob Pattinson and Kristen Stewart. But I remember her taste. I was like, wow. Like, she was finding, like, the coolest photos of Rob Pattinson, and she had great taste. And so we had a prototype done by, let's say, August 13th. It was right around my birthday. And so we took it out to show studios, and they're all, you know, you'll never be able to pull this off. Like, all this media that covers Hollywood is doomed. It's like, but, you know, anyway, what I'm saying is there was a ton of skepticism, and also a ton of skepticism about, can Us Weekly lady come and do this very different thing? And, you know, I think if people who are here remember, The Hollywood Reporter was not just failing. It was like...
flatline.
I mean, like, already underground. And sort of it had a sadness all around it. So it was definitely like bad news bears. Like, you have the staff who has been misdirected or not directed right. for years.
They're losing, but it's not necessarily their fault.
Right. And so, like, there's an inertia that's set in where they don't know. Like, they don't know what's good from bad because nobody tells them. They don't care. They're burnt out.
They need leadership.
Yes. And so, like, I kept the staff, like, all these people. But I'm sure you'll remember this era of Hollywood where, like, the so-called trade press is so beholden to the studios.
Premiere magazine.
Yes. And it just becomes press release central, right? And, like, you're...
Well, I mean, in my own case, I do a movie with my ex-wife. We do this movie, The Marrying Man.
Yeah.
And the Susan Lyne is the head of Premiere mm-hmm. magazine. And you realize that the PR department of the studios are just faxing her the articles
yes.
of what to write.
Yeah.
Most of what happened that was painted as misbehaving stars on the set of a movie,
right.
much of it was people having honest creative differences. When
yes.
you walk in, what really distinguishes The Hollywood Reporter under your tutelage and when you're there under your leadership is you go to that level where you become a real
yes.
honest magazine.
Yes.
You're not like Premiere magazine was a shitty magazine.
Uh-huh.
If someone called me up and they said to me, and I was like a child, I was in my career infancy when someone said to me, what do you think that Premiere magazine is going to do? They're going to take your word for it, you and this woman who you're dating,
yes.
or they're going to do the bidding of the studio that releases 30 movies a year.
And advertises.
Of course you're going to get crushed. Where does the spine of it becoming a really, really smart
God,
magazine come from?
It is so fascinating to me. And I think you see this in so much political coverage, the way they would self-censor themselves. Like, people come in, they go interview someone and they say, oh my God, like, you wouldn't believe this crazy thing someone said. And then you get the story and it's not in there. And I remember this happened several times. And I would say to the person, like, why is that not in there?
Why are you protecting them?
Well, I just don't think they would like it. I'm like, who cares? Like, why do you care? Like, they said it. Like, and they said it probably because they want you to use it, right? And not like crazy gotcha stuff, but
right.
like, Hollywood had gotten into the heads of these reporters where they were protecting them but not even supporting them or financially supporting the publication or whatever. And you know, I also remember this one time, like, you know, I was the new editor and there was this one reporter there. And I'm sure you must remember when Nikki Fink was here.
Sure.
And, you know, and so Nikki Fink is trying to reach this reporter at the office, no doubt to try to report something terrible about us. And so he's trying to reach this reporter, and the reporter, we're in a news meeting. The reporter's like, oh my God, Nikki's calling. I have to run out. I'm like, why are you like giving power to someone like that? Like, what is wrong with you? And so they were all kind of like, it was like a collective self-esteem problem.
Who's the executive at Warner Brothers who greenlit bringing TMZ to TV? Do you know what it's like to walk down the corridors of Warner Brothers and we're going to go down one hallway and there's all the people producing films and television that I might be in, and you go down that hallway and there's Harvey Levin, who they're making money off of, who's out there trying to kill me. Was it Peter Roth? I mean, who brought TMZ to Warner Brothers? I'm going, like, shame on you. Why did you do that? And why are you? Because what they realized was, here's Hedda Hopper. Here's Army Archard. Here's Walter Winchell. Here's Luella Parsons, the old dinosaurs. And Rona Barrett, when I was a little boy, you know, on TV. And the studios would work really, really hard to control and manage their stories about out-of-wedlock babies and interracial marriages and abortions and alcoholism and sanitariums. I'm using all the language of that period. And their drug addiction and their this and their DUIs and their divorces and their spousal abuse. And they would try to bury all that. And then one day some guy wakes up and goes, why are we breaking our ass trying to protect these people? Let's make money off of the fornicating, puerile idiocy of the stars. Why are we protecting the stars? Let's just lay it out there. Janice Min started her career as a crime reporter for the local paper in Westchester County. On the same beat at the same time in Baltimore was screenwriting phenom David Simon. Then in 1993, both found their calling. Min at People, Simon at the TV show based on his book, Homicide.
They offered me the chance to write the pilot. And I said, maybe wisely, maybe not. Wisely because I didn't know what the hell I would have been doing. I said, get somebody who knows what they're doing to do this. I'm a newspaperman. But maybe unwisely when I saw the per episode royalty that went to that guy.
Sure.
You know?
Eventually, Simon agreed, and the rest is TV history. Hear the rest of that interview at heresthething.org. Coming up, Janice Min and I discuss Me Too and Woody Allen. This is Alec Baldwin. And you're listening to Here's the Thing. For nearly 25 years, Janice Min has been at the white-hot center of celebrity journalism, covering stars and the business of selling them. So she's seen the sexism and discrimination in show business up close, edited dozens of articles about it, and Janice Min worries that the Harvey Weinstein moment is being squandered. Her concern is this: that powerful men who could be pushed to solve structural problems are getting a free pass because of the focus on individual sexual harassers.
I'm afraid of revolution without a successful outcome, right? Mm. I mean, this is a thing that I find frustrating about Time's Up and Me Too and all this stuff. This culture of victimology among women, right? That like women have no agency. They have no ability to control these situations or get out of them. And I understand there's a power imbalance and you felt indebted. Walk out the door. And like there's certain things where you're reading them. And some of it's generational, I think. But the Aziz Ansari thing, I'm reading and I'm like, okay, where's the bad part? Where's the bad part? I'm like, what? Like, that's, it's done. And like, I
let's focus less on Aziz Ansari. And I don't want you to ignore that because men need to learn how, and I say this to my daughter who's 22. I say that, remember when she was like 15, I remember sitting to her down and I said to her, remember, I said, it's not only that men will say anything to get you to do what they want, because men will say anything to get you to do that.
Right.
I said, some of them are very good at it.
Right. Like from a very young age, how do you teach girls to not feel disempowered in these relationships they have when they go into work and with boys and with men and people at a higher level, men? They've been, you know, painfully silent on these issues. And it's sort of women losing it over this stuff and scaring men to death, And so but how do you actually move this conversation to something productive where you actually create a path for better gender representation in positions of power?
And making a very striking kind of bold move that's going to have some resonance, for example. I mean, this is just off the top of my head. The famous movie star is on the set of the film and she says, I'm not going to come to work tomorrow.
Right.
Until you have the head of the studio come down and have lunch with me. I'm going to shut down the film tomorrow.
Right.
Have Bob so-and-so come down. What are you guys going to do? I don't feel comfortable working for your company.
Yes.
You had Ratner here. You had Rat Packet, whatever. Tell me what you're going to do. What are you actively doing to make me feel more comfortable and really get the people who have the juice?
Yes.
Who's in charge?
Right.
What are we doing? You can get all the Aziz and Ansaris you want. When do we get the people that are in charge of the networks and the studios to pump
me
up?
And you know, you saw Gal, Wonder Woman. She did that, right? She said Brett Ratner couldn't be a part of Wonder Woman 2 or whatever. And she got him off the film. But I think fundamentally, there's such a power structure here. And you see this in the pay inequity stuff that is becoming sort of an all-consuming topic here. Like, but all of it's sort of tied into the same thing about who has power and who has the ability to exploit that power. And it is 99% a male-female thing, but it also is the sort of culture of the town. But the real thing is there's something uncomfortably pornographic about the kind of endless outing of the sexual...
It's very masturbatory.
You could out men until the end of time. Like, you could do it every day. You could have a news channel devoted to this.
We should start that. We could make a lot of money.
But the Hollywood thing is particularly frustrating to me. And, you know, Amanda Hess in the New York Times wrote a scathing story about the Time's Up movement the other day about how it's all just activism and not action, right? Basically taking the actual hard questions about Hollywood and power and abuse and turning it into a fashion moment.
It's not really going to get us anywhere. I really want to see somebody. I keep saying, you got to convict Harvey.
Right.
If Harvey's a guy who got Mossad agents trying to bury all the people who he raped, let's get him in jail.
Right.
My mistake has been that I thought that certain things went without saying. If Woody Allen is guilty of what they claim he is guilty of, you don't think I want him punished for that in whatever way? But put yourself in this position, which is, it's the sentencing phase of a horrible crime.
Right.
And his mother is sitting there in the front row for him in the corner.
Yeah.
It's her son.
Yeah.
They're my friends.
Right.
My impulse is to help them and to understand them and to support them. If men that I know, Jimmy Toback is one, if men that I know are guilty of some crime, I don't want them to skate on that. Because I'm an actor, we're trained to think about alternatives. What might have happened? What might you have done to avoid this? When I see men by their own hand destroy their lives and ruin the lives of their wives and their children, I mean, their name is shit for the rest of them. I find that very disturbing and very, very painful. But Harvey Weinstein, he's the low-hanging fruit.
Yes.
And you've got to prosecute him and you've got to convict him so that everybody understands there's real consequences. Just talking about it in the press and talking about it on Twitter and retweeting articles from Ronan this and this one and that one and all the people who are supportive of it, I said, that's not going to get it done. You need to have a trial. But the Woody thing is so complicated.
You know, he is his worst character witness, right? All the circumstantial evidence around Woody is like, you know, is never going to prove to you and people who don't believe he sexually assaulted his daughter that he did it.
It doesn't help.
It doesn't help. It doesn't help.
All those movies don't help.
They do not help. And so I think there are people who think on that fact alone, he should go away. He needs to, you know, never work again because he made movies that today could be viewed as incredibly...
creeping people out.
Yeah, totally creepy. One of our really fine reporters, Stephen Galloway, had interviewed Woody Allen for the cover of The Hollywood Reporter that sort of set all of this off. And Woody said creepy things in the story, like including in the way he talked about his wife, Soon Yi, which was, you would describe it as sort of highly narcissistic in how Soon Yi kind of serves him.
Like a geisha.
Yes, totally. And so then, you know, Ronan Farrow had put something on Twitter, which I saw, and he said, I love Janice Min, but what the hell was she thinking? And because Ronan didn't feel like Stephen had pushed Woody hard enough on this alleged sexual assault of his sister. And like we say to Ronan, okay, write something about it then if you want. And, you know, he wrote this very well-argued, well-written essay about how Hollywood has skated over the Woody Allen issue and does not believe, and which is so funny to think about now, but does not believe accusers. And you could see the winds of change coming. That story took off. Huge. And it was just came this enormous thing.
Led to the New Yorker piece.
Yes.
Let me ask you this, though, because we're going to run out of time. At one point, I was supposed to go to Columbia School of Journalism. I was going to do a program with you.
Yes.
And you couldn't make it.
Correct.
It was going to be on the panel. It was you, me, and Nick Denton.
Oh, my God.
And I was told then your schedule will change and you couldn't come. And when you dropped out, I dropped out because I said, I'm not going to go with, I was not a fan of Denton's and that operation. When they went bankrupt and that whole thing happened with Hulk Hogan, what did you think about that?
God, you know, okay, so obviously there was so much schadenfreude in the ether about that, right? And then you're like, oh, Peter Thiel's bankrolling this. And, you know, and then you're like Charles Harder, and it starts to get like, then you start to feel sort of icky about it. And then you come around to like, and so Nick Denton and I always have gotten along. And for whatever reason, they never went after, these are the terrible things about me, but they never went after me as one of their characters that they like to torture. And so I think people feel kind of wistful about some of their stuff now because sometimes, like, whatever moment we're in with this Trump moment, like, one of the things that I find refreshing is, like, people will just say anything now and do anything, right? Like, any sort of polite veneer on the truth, you can just blow it away, right? And I think that was one of the things Gawker did. And so you see some of what they reported on, like Louis C.K., right? I saw a lot of references to that when the Louis C.K. stuff
came
out.
Taro, going
and,
after him.
Yes, and Gawker was the first to sort of get into that story. And so, like, a really good Gawker writer could write about the absurdity of all of it, right? And so I missed that. But, you know, it's scary. It's had a very severe chilling effect where you believe a journalistic organization, a single attorney can bankrupt you, you know. Well, I think these decisions that were probably treated much more cavalierly, and that's the wrong word, but much more boldly in an operation, you're made to scrutinize them much more. And, you know, there was, and this under this threat of like a Charles Harder or one of these attorneys. And, you know, Charles Harder, as you saw with Harvey Weinstein, and he did it with one of our journalists, the Hollywood Reporter, Kim Masters, they create this whole strategy, and they did it with Lisa Bloom, where you no longer undermine the story, which you can't, sometimes can't dispute, you undermine the journalist. And, you know, with Kim Masters, she was reporting on Roy Price at Amazon, his whole sexual harassment of a showrunner who was involved with The Man in the High Castle. And they created this fake story that they said to Matt Bellany, who was the editor who took over for me, that Kim Masters had been, you know, she was soliciting money from Roy for her show on KCRW. She has a show on KCRW called The Business about Hollywood. And, you know, when he said no, that's when she decided to go after him. So then you can set up this whole malicious intent argument that can get in people's heads. And so Kim, who would, like, never, she is like the most straight arrow journalist of all time. So Kim has.
Could they prove that she solicited him for money?
No. So you know, they said it's in an email. And so they go through this, like, weeks of stuff where then finally, you know, the Hollywood Reporter's attorneys and Matt have to say, like, give us the email. Oh, we'll get it to you. We'll get it to you. Of course, it doesn't exist. And but by that time, they've seeded all this sort of doubt.
They've accomplished their goal.
Yes, and it's one of these things where, I mean, it's sort of what Roger Ailes did with Gabe Sherman, being able to sort of say the person has an agenda. You know, it'll all come out in court how this person has had it out for me, us, and, you know, a lot of newsrooms. And Kim had a terrible time. She shopped that story at multiple other outlets. People were scared. Like, well, oh, though, you know, if the Hollywood Reporter didn't run it, there must be something wrong. Like, why would we run it? It had to go from place to place to place. And finally, this outlet that's a, you know, a very well-regarded upstart called The Information that comes out of Silicon Valley. It is self-funded by this woman who has family money on her own. She was the one who ran it. And when someone else did it, validated it, they weren't sued, then it became a story to cover. And that is just one example of a story I know. So you can see how, you know, 1,000 other stories probably every week get ground into nothingness.
You're this ragingly smart woman, and you should make movies and TV because we need smart women in movies and TV.
Oh, God. Television, maybe not movies. Movies are such a long process.
Call me.
Oh,
we'll
my
just
God.
Have lunch and talk about it.
Absolutely. We're on.
Thank you so much for doing
Thank
this.
You for
really
having me.
Really very grateful. That was Janice Min, the visionary turnaround artist behind Us Weekly and The Hollywood Reporter. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.